Franklin Roosevelt once said, "I like this boy, Lyndon Johnson. He's one of the most promising young men I've ever met. He reminds me of me." These words, spoken about a gangly, ambitious Texan who would eventually occupy the same Oval Office, reveal the extraordinary magnetism of a man who would transform American politics. Robert Caro's monumental biography, The Path to Power, takes us deep into the formative years of America's 36th president, revealing how a poor boy from the Texas Hill Country developed the ruthless political instincts that would eventually make him one of the most consequential presidents in American history. The book has captivated readers across the political spectrum since its publication, with Barack Obama listing it among his favorite books and George W. Bush reportedly keeping it on his nightstand during his presidency. Its unflinching examination of power, how it's acquired, wielded, and the toll it takes on those who seek it has made it required reading in political science departments nationwide. Through Caro's meticulous research and vivid storytelling, we witness the birth of a political genius whose tactics would forever change Washington while simultaneously glimpsing the darkness that often accompanied his relentless ambition. The story of Lyndon Johnson begins with the land that shaped him, the Texas Hill Country, a deceptively beautiful region that Caro calls a trap baited with grass. Early settlers were seduced by its rolling hills, clear streams, and lush grasslands, believing they had found paradise. What they couldn't know was that this verdant landscape existed in precarious balance, with thin soil atop limestone bedrock and rainfall patterns that would prove cruelly deceptive. For generations, the hill country broke the spirits of those who tried to tame it. The grass that had grown over centuries could be virgin only once. Once plowed under for cotton or trampled by cattle, the thin soil washed away during heavy rains or blew away during droughts. What had appeared as paradise gradually revealed itself as a harsh, unforgiving land of stone. Into this trap walked the Johnson family. While their Bunton relatives had wisely stopped at the edge of the hill country, the Johnsons pressed deeper, boasting they would become the richest men in Texas. They briefly prospered during the post-Civil War cattle boom, with Sam Johnson's brother Tom once returning from a cattle drive with $100,000 in gold coins in his saddlebags. But like so many others, they were undone by the land's harsh realities. After the devastating drought of 1888, the family lost nearly everything. What made the Johnsons particularly ill-suited to this environment was their temperament. They were intellectuals and dreamers in a place that demanded pragmatic hardness. While other hill country families discussed crops and weather at dinner, the Johnsons debated politics and philosophy. Sam Johnson Sr. subscribed to Austin newspapers when few received any papers at all, and would change churches after theological debates with ministers. These were men of ideas in a place that demanded calloused hands and stoic acceptance of nature's cruelties. By the time Lyndon's father, Sam Ely Johnson Jr., was born in 1877, the family's fortunes had collapsed. The once prosperous cattle drivers had become struggling farmers on increasingly barren land. This cycle of hope and disappointment would repeat itself with Sam Jr., who briefly found success in politics and farming before losing everything in a disastrous cotton speculation. By the 1920s, the Johnson name had become synonymous with failure in the hill country, a burden that would shape young Lyndon's desperate ambition. The Hill Country's economic devastation gave birth to America's greatest agrarian revolt, the populist movement. Beginning in nearby Lampasas County in 1877, desperate farmers formed the Farmers' Alliance that eventually evolved into the People's Party. Letters from Hill Country farmers to the Alliance journal Southern Mercury revealed their isolation and desperation. "I never got to go to school in my life, nor learn my letters till I was 35 years old," confessed one correspondent. These farmers believed government should redress their grievances, since government policies had created their problems in the first place. Railroad subsidies, high tariffs protecting manufacturers, and the gold standard that depressed crop prices all were government actions that oppressed farmers. The 1892 People's Party platform declared the powers of government, in other words, of the people, should be expanded to the end that oppression, injustice, and poverty shall eventually cease in the land. Sam Johnson Jr. emerged as a passionate populist voice. Elected to the Texas legislature in 1904, he championed bills to preserve the Alamo, ban cruel calf roping contests, and exempt poor counties from wolf bounty payments. Working alongside fellow populists, Honest Buck Gray and Claude Hudspeth, Sam earned widespread respect through quiet and consistent attention to duty rather than speechmaking. His principles came at a personal cost. In 1907, Sam stood as one of only seven legislators who refused to support Joseph Weldon Bailey's re-election to the Senate amid corruption allegations, despite enormous pressure from railroad and oil interests. Though respected for being straight as a shingle, his principles cost him financially. Unable to pay his debts or support his new wife on his meager legislative salary, Sam declined to run for a third term in 1908, and unlike other retiring legislators, was offered no lucrative position with the railroads or oil companies he had opposed. Young Lyndon absorbed these political lessons, watching his father's principled stance earn respect, but little else. The populist dream of government helping citizens fight forces too powerful to battle alone had simply come too early. Franklin Roosevelt wasn't their president yet, Caro writes. Lyndon Johnson wasn't their congressman. Lyndon Johnson's parents represented a stark contrast in backgrounds and temperaments. Sam Johnson had married someone as idealistic as himself. Rebecca Baines, raised in a stately white stone house near Blanco, was the daughter of Joseph Wilson Baines, a respected attorney, former legislator, and Secretary of State under Governor Ireland. After her father's financial ruin through disastrous droughts and overkindness to farm tenants, Rebecca, a college graduate who taught elocution, met Sam Johnson while interviewing him for an Austin newspaper. Their marriage united two very different worlds. Sam was a man of the people, rough-hewn, passionate about politics, comfortable in the company of farmers and ranchers. Rebecca was refined and literary, devoted to education and culture. Despite their differences, they connected through their shared political ideals, particularly their admiration for William Jennings Bryan. After a whirlwind courtship, they married in August 1907. Life on the Pedernales River proved especially difficult for Rebecca. Without telephone or neighbors to talk with, she faced what historian Walter Prescott Webb called the nauseating loneliness of hill country farm wives. When Sam was away on legislative business, she endured not just loneliness but dread. Nights in pitch darkness with no visible lights in any direction, alone with rustling trees, splashes in the river, and howling winds. Despite these hardships, Rebecca maintained her standards, using proper tablecloths rather than oilcloth, and making rituals out of little things, like serving tea in thin cups. She was deeply embarrassed that three of her five children were delivered by midwife rather than doctor, a fact she would later omit from family records, preferring to credit the attending physician. In 1913, after Lyndon and two daughters were born, the family moved to Johnson City, into a white frame house with Victorian gingerbread scrawlwork. But Johnson City was primitive, a town where bread couldn't be purchased, indoor plumbing was nearly non-existent, and the sense of isolation remained overwhelming. Their home wasn't one of bitter conflict, as some biographers portrayed, but rather a place where Sam would kid Rebecca about her ancestry and make her laugh and laugh. They shared core values despite their differences and would sit talking for hours, especially about politics. For a while, Sam's business ventures prospered, cotton farming, real estate deals, and even purchasing the local newspaper and hotel, allowing Rebecca leisure time for her literary pursuits and community activities. Lyndon Johnson's early years revealed his intense desire for attention and leadership. From toddlerhood, he was remarkably restless and determined, constantly running away despite his parents' fears. When just 18 months old, he would toddle determinately across country to visit relatives, his face showing utter maturity of expression. His mother noted his highly inquisitive mind, but these escapes terrified her, especially when he might wander near the Pedernales River. With peers, Lyndon was domineering. Though younger and smaller than his cousin Ava, he insisted on riding in front on her donkey. Even with boys much older, he became the head of the ring in all activities. If he couldn't lead, he wouldn't play, taking his baseball home if not allowed to pitch despite lacking skill. By age 10, he gravitated to adult spaces like the barber shop, reading the town's only newspaper first, and pontificating to grown men about current events, arguing persistently with anyone who disagreed. Politics became Lyndon's greatest passion from an early age. At the Johnson dinner table, Sam insisted the children engage with political topics like government ownership of railroads, the Socialist Party, and the League of Nations. After meals, Sam would organize spelling bees, arithmetic contests, and formal debates with the children lined up before the fireplace. Father and son would have long conversations on the back porch swing, with Lyndon ignoring friends' calls to play. The resemblance between them grew striking as Lyndon reached adolescence, both physically and in mannerisms, particularly their habit of getting uncomfortably close during conversations, grabbing arms and lapels. But neighbors noted a crucial difference. While Sam was genuinely friendly beneath his intensity, Lyndon was driven by a need to dominate and win arguments at all costs. As Sam's financial fortunes collapsed in the early 1920s, the relationship between father and son deteriorated. The once proud Johnson strut became an object of ridicule in Johnson City. Banker, who once courted Sam's greetings, now sneered at him, playing cowboy. Even those who benefited from his political work, like pension recipients, joined in the mockery. O.Y. Fawcett, the local druggist, coined a phrase that gained wide circulation: Sam Johnson is too smart to work and not smart enough to make a living without working. Young Lyndon, witnessing his father's humiliation, began openly defying him. He refused to do farm chores when Sam was away, ordering his younger siblings to do his work instead. He deliberately provoked his mother at mealtimes by eating with loud, slurping noises and cramming food into his mouth. Most significantly, he rejected his parents' emphasis on education, refusing to attend college despite their pleas, a decision that deeply wounded these education-devoted parents. With the collapse of Sam Johnson's fortunes came a dramatic transformation in his relationship with his son Lyndon. Those who saw them together in 1918-1920, when Sam was successful, recall a son who idolized his father. But those who observed them in 1921-1923, after Sam's failure, describe a defiant boy who openly disobeyed his father and showed little respect. Lyndon's reactions to perceived injuries were dramatic. After being spanked by a neighbor for fighting, 10-year-old Lyndon let out a wail so loud I can still remember it, standing there with one knee breeches leg fallen down, covered in dust, screaming. You could hear him from one end of town to the other. This pattern continued into his teens. Whenever he lost fights, he would run home crying loudly through the streets. All anyone had to do was touch Lyndon, and he let out a wail you could hear all over town, recalled one neighbor. He wanted attention. He wanted everyone to know someone had injured him. With adults, particularly women, Lyndon displayed extraordinary charm and physical affection that amazed his peers. He would approach mothers in their freshly starched white dresses, hug them despite being dirty from fighting, and say, "Oh, Ms. Redford, we didn't mean any harm. Why don't you let us play?" She would relent immediately. Other children quickly learned to let Lyndon do the asking when they wanted parental permission. He could get them to let us do things that ordinarily they'd say no to. What drove Lyndon's behavior? His exaggerated reactions to punishment, false claims of hunger, and public complaints about his family? Was it, as one neighbor believed, because he wanted people to feel sorry for him? For a boy who needed attention and distinction from his earliest years, now trapped in an undistinguished, poor family with only average academic abilities, perhaps pity was the only distinction possible. Despite his desperate efforts, Lyndon couldn't escape being identified as a Johnson in a town where family was the primary identification. His was a family steeped in scandal, going back 50 years when the original Johnson brothers went broke, leaving debts across the hill country. Now history seemed to be repeating with Sam and Tom Johnson. One resident recalled his uncle watching Lyndon walk by and declaring with finality, "He'll never amount to anything. Too much like Sam." This judgment was painfully reinforced after Lyndon's high school graduation in 1924. Though he and classmate Kitty Clyde Ross were in love throughout their senior spring, her father, E.P. Ross, the richest man in town and one of Sam Johnson's creditors, forbade the relationship. When the school principal, Arthur Krause, asked permission to court Kitty Clyde, Ross encouraged it despite the age difference, as the Rosses were so afraid Kitty Clyde was going to marry Lyndon. Lyndon would often see the Ross car drive by with Kitty Clyde and Krause inside, a painful reminder of his rejection. Southwest Texas State Teachers College was the Hill Country's only college, a modest institution with just four buildings perched on San Marcos's highest hill. For young people from the Hill Country's Dog Run houses, Old Main spires represented their only chance of escaping lives of physical toil. Lyndon had additional reasons for anxiety. 3 years away from school had eroded his already inadequate education, and Johnson City High graduates needed to prove themselves through qualifying examinations in subjects like algebra and geometry, his weakest areas. With barely enough money for registration and no financial support from his father, he feared having to leave school within weeks if he couldn't secure funds. Johnson quickly transformed his humble campus job on the Rock Squad into an opportunity. While other students silently raked and lifted, he engaged President Cecil Eugene Evans in conversation whenever possible. The aloof, dignified Prexy Evans surprisingly responded to Lyndon's overtures, drawn by their shared interest in politics. Within 5 weeks of arrival, he'd created and secured a position as Evans' office boy at $15 monthly, a job that hadn't previously existed. Despite his outward confidence, Lyndon suffered periods of deep depression at San Marcos. These down periods often coincided with delays in his mother's nearly daily letters of effusive encouragement. His estrangement from his father remained complete. Though he proudly displayed improved grades to Sam, saying, "Does that look like I've got enough sense to take a college education?" his letters home were addressed only to "Dearest Mother," never acknowledging his father, despite Rebecca's entreaties. Johnson quickly positioned himself for campus prominence, securing the role of writing articles for the campus newspaper. As editor-in-chief of the College Star, he made his mark with oversized headlines and writing that showed early political instincts, lavishing extravagant praise on college officials regardless of their actual campus reputation. He portrayed the feared Dean Brogdon as one of the best sports on the Hill, and wrote that Dr. Evans's notoriously dull speeches bristled with interesting facts. Johnson's flattery extended beyond his writing. He placed strategic notes at the end of examination papers, tailoring each message to its recipient. In faculty discussions, he would literally sit at professors' feet, face upturned in rapt attention, never disagreeing with anything they said. Students noticed he would enthusiastically agree with completely opposite viewpoints from different professors on consecutive days. While faculty adored Johnson's deference, students disliked his contrasting behavior toward them. At Mrs. Gates's boarding house, students remembered his grabbing for the largest portions of food and monopolizing conversation. Though sometimes entertaining with stories, he just wouldn't let others speak. His tendency to exaggerate achievements and appropriate others' ideas alienated classmates who doubted his political connections. Students began asking him questions just to laugh at his transparent lies, like claiming his 10-cent tie from Woolworth's was actually a dollar tie from Austin's fancy Scarborough store. The most popular students on campus were the athletes, who formed a secret organization called the Black Stars. When Johnson was unanimously rejected for membership, he helped form a rival group called the White Stars. Johnson's political acumen transformed campus politics. He orchestrated sophisticated campaigns, manipulated voting procedures, and even blackmailed a brilliant writer named Ruth Lewis into withdrawing from an election by threatening to expose a trivial lie about her briefly attending another university. Johnson's political strategy was remarkable through its secrecy. While he'd always been prone to boasting in other areas of life, he maintained absolute discretion about his political maneuvers. He implemented strict secrecy rules for the White Stars. No three members could be seen talking together on campus. Meetings moved to the Hoffines Hotel, where windows couldn't be observed, and members could even deny membership if directly asked. So successful was this secrecy that the Black Stars didn't know we were organized. Nobody knew. In just over a year after returning from Catula, Johnson had engineered a remarkable political transformation. The campus hierarchy that had once scorned him was now controlled by his allies. Class presidents, student council members, Gillardians, star and pedagogue editors, all positions once held by his enemies, had been systematically captured by Johnson loyalists. Despite being one of the most disliked students, he had created and manipulated the campus political structure with astonishing effectiveness, displaying what his brother Sam called his natural vocation for political stratagems. Johnson's teaching experience in Catula, Texas, revealed another dimension of his complex character. Driving south of San Antonio, he entered the desolate South Texas brush country, a vast, flat, treeless plain where temperatures regularly reached 110 degrees. Catula, 60 miles from the Mexican border, was primarily populated by Mexican residents who lived in crumbling shanties on the wrong side of the railroad tracks. As the principal at Wellhausen School, Johnson transformed education for his Mexican students through tireless dedication. He demanded excellence, instituted strict English-only policies, and stayed after school with struggling students until assignments were completed. Most significantly, he repeatedly told them that through education, any baby might grow up to become president. His passion stemmed partly from seeing these children as his first real opportunity to be respected and admired. When a student once mocked his walk, Johnson spanked him and declared the class was looking at the future president of the United States. Despite his outward confidence, Johnson showed occasional insecurity, insisting students sing a song praising him when he entered the classroom. In Catula, Johnson was desperately lonely, writing daily to his mother and looking forward to rooming with his friend Booty when returning to San Marcos. His courtship of Carol Davis ended when she chose postal clerk Harold Smith, who shared her interest in music rather than Johnson's obsession with politics. The Catula experience had a profound impact on Johnson's worldview. Years later, as president, he would recall, "I shall never forget the faces of the boys and the girls in that little Wellhausen Mexican school, and I remember even yet the pain of realizing and knowing then that college was closed to practically every one of those children because they were too poor. And I think it was then that I made up my mind that this nation could never rest while the door to knowledge remained closed to any American." When Congressman James P. Buchanan died suddenly in February 1937, Johnson immediately recognized his opportunity. Though only 28 and virtually unknown outside his small congressional district, Johnson launched an audacious campaign for the vacant seat. The odds seemed insurmountable. He represented the district's smallest county, Blanco, with barely 2% of the district's population, and faced seven other candidates, including four seasoned politicians. Johnson's campaign was revolutionary in its intensity. While his opponents delayed their campaigns, Avery starting March 9, Harris March 18, and Brownlee not until March 27, Johnson had already completed a tour of the entire district by March 5 when the election date was set. Each morning before dawn, Johnson would collect his daily itinerary from campaign headquarters at the Stephen F. Austin Hotel, then head out with his chauffeur Carol Keach to traverse the unfamiliar district. Johnson's formal speeches, delivered from prepared texts written by Wirtz and Henderson, proved ineffective despite their appropriate New Deal themes. But in person-to-person interactions, Johnson transformed. His face would light up with genuine warmth when greeting someone. His remarkable memory for names, faces, and shared experiences created instant connections. When meeting voters, Johnson would grasp their hands while asking personal questions, then invariably find some connection. "I know your mother," or "I've met so-and-so." Johnson's campaign focused on a single powerful message: Roosevelt, 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 100% for Roosevelt. This slogan dominated his posters, calling cards, and letters. He shrewdly positioned the special election as the first opportunity for voters to support Roosevelt's controversial judicial reform plan, declaring, "The paramount issue of this campaign is whether the president shall be sustained in his program for readjustment of the judicial system." Johnson's campaign intensity reached extraordinary levels. He insisted on visiting every voter, no matter how remote. When finding a farm they'd missed, Johnson would turn the car around without hesitation, even after exhausting days. "We would go back, no matter how hungry and tired we were," recalled Keach. As his cousin Ava Johnson Cox observed, he went to the people that no one had ever gone to. He went to the people on the forks of the creeks. On election day, Johnson made a critical tactical error. After voting in Johnson City and napping at the Stephen F. Austin Hotel, he learned he was leading in early returns. When South Texas political bosses called to ask when to report their county's votes, Johnson instructed them to report immediately, violating the cardinal rule of Texas politics to withhold controlled precincts until knowing what totals were needed. By 9:30 that evening, Johnson led O'Daniel by over 13,000 votes. Supporters hoisted him on their shoulders in wild celebration as newspapers prepared headlines declaring his victory. Lady Bird recalled, "He was announced the winner. We were talking about staff." But in Texas, not all votes were counted on election day. While urban votes using voting machines were tallied immediately, some rural precincts using paper ballots wouldn't report for days. As Monday dawned, mysterious late returns from East Texas counties showed dramatic reversals favoring O'Daniel. By Tuesday, O'Daniel had pulled ahead by over 1,000 votes. The bitter irony wasn't lost on Johnson. After 10 years of meticulous planning and relentless work, he had relaxed for just one day. And he had lost. Having secured the financing and authorization for 4 dams along the lower Colorado, Johnson now tackled an even more difficult challenge, bringing electricity to the Hill Country. By 1937, electricity had been an integral part of urban American life for over a generation, but in Johnson's congressional district, it remained virtually non-existent. Without electricity, Hill Country farmers milked cows by hand in pre-dawn darkness, hauled water bucket by bucket from wells, often 100 feet deep, and performed countless laborious tasks that had been mechanized elsewhere decades earlier. Women suffered even more severely, carrying hundreds of pounds of water daily, chopping and hauling wood, and cooking on blazing hot wood stoves even during the scorching summer months. The washing process was brutally labor-intensive. Women would scrub clothes in zinc wash tubs, then punch them in boiling water with a broomstick, rinse them in separate tubs, and finally treat them with bluing and starch. Tuesday brought the even more dreaded ironing day, using 6-pound solid iron wedges heated on wood stoves. These sad irons burned women's hands, required constant cleaning, and forced them to stand for hours in suffocating kitchen heat. Despite months of effort by county agents, the Pedernales Electric Co-op seemed doomed, with fewer than 2 customers per mile signed up, far below the REA's required 3 per mile minimum. Johnson warned farmers that if they didn't establish their cooperative, Texas Power and Light might buy the dam-generated electricity and offer it only at unaffordable rates. After failing with the REA Administrator John Carmody, Johnson asked Tommy Corcoran to arrange a meeting with President Roosevelt himself. On September 27, 1938, a telegram arrived at the PEC's Johnson City office announcing the REA had granted a $1,322,000 loan, later increased to $1,800,000, to build 1,830 miles of electric lines serving 2,892 Hill Country families. In November 1939, the lights came on across the Hill Country. As Evelyn Smith and her parents returned home one evening, her mother initially feared their house was on fire, only to realize, "No, Mama, the lights are on." Stella Glidden recalls, "All over the Hill Country, people began to name their kids for Lyndon Johnson." Johnson strategically maintained relationships after Election Day through carefully crafted letters to powerful officials. Each letter portrayed Johnson as humbly grateful to that specific official for giving him his opportunity in the 1940 campaign, with flattery customized to appeal to each recipient's ego. Most significantly, he wrote directly to Roosevelt, thanking him for allowing him to whiff a bit of the powder in the campaign. Johnson and Roosevelt developed a significant rapport, meeting frequently in the Oval Office and the president's private quarters. They discussed Texas politics, with Roosevelt increasingly making Johnson his point man for Texas matters, even over established figures like Jesse Jones. Lady Bird recalled her husband returning from White House meetings on a sort of high, while Roosevelt considered Johnson a most remarkable young man and told staff he was a comer and a real liberal. Roosevelt even told Ickes that Johnson could well be the first Southern president. Johnson meticulously cultivated relationships with everyone in the White House, from secretaries to top officials. He had won over presidential secretaries Marvin McTyre and Edwin Pa Watson, with Watson calling him a perfect Roosevelt man. Most crucially, Johnson befriended Roosevelt's personal secretaries Missy LeHond and Grace Tully, gaining privileged, off-the-record access to the president. Despite his talent for arousing paternal feelings in powerful men like Rayburn, Miller, Adams, and Wirtz, Lyndon Johnson had been unable to translate affection into advancement. From the very day of his appointment as congressional secretary in 1931, he had viewed the position as merely a stepping stone, the bottom rung of a political ladder he was desperate to climb. But by 1935, nearly 4 years later, he remained stuck on that same rung. Johnson's ambition governed every action. As he had written years earlier, it is ambition that makes of a creature a real man. Pride, embarrassment, gloating, these were luxuries he wouldn't indulge. He immediately worked to secure Jesse Kellum's permanent appointment as NYA's Texas director, recognizing the agency's value as a potential statewide political organization. Just as he had used Clegg-Burg's position as a stepping stone, Johnson was already planning his next political move. Pearl Harbor derailed Lyndon Johnson's career plans. He had expected to challenge Pappy O'Daniel again in 1942, with strong indications of Roosevelt's support and the advantage of name recognition from his previous campaign. With Brown and Root's financial backing and his established statewide organization, Johnson felt confident of victory. But the war, and his pledge to serve in it, made running impossible, delaying his Senate ambitions by 7 years. When Johnson finally ran again in 1948, his platform had fundamentally changed. Once the perfect Roosevelt man who proclaimed 100% support for the New Deal, Johnson had quietly shifted allegiance to Texas's powerful conservative rulers. By 1948, he openly attacked big labor racketeers and communist union leaders, a complete reversal from his first Senate campaign when he called himself a friend of labor. The Dallas Chamber of Commerce, one of America's most reactionary business groups, found his record satisfactorily conservative and endorsed him enthusiastically. Johnson even downplayed his New Deal support, claiming he had voted for only 13 of 27 major New Deal bills. This transformation shocked liberal supporters like Harold Young and Bill Kittrell, but as his Dodge Hotel roommates had observed years earlier, Lyndon goes which way the wind blows. Before the paint had even faded on billboards proclaiming his loyalty to Franklin Roosevelt, Lyndon Johnson had already turned against him. Throughout his career, Johnson displayed a remarkable talent for adapting to changing political environments. His ability to read the prevailing winds and position himself accordingly would become one of his defining characteristics. This political flexibility, some would call it opportunism, allowed him to navigate the treacherous waters of Texas and national politics with remarkable success. The patterns established in Johnson's early years would continue throughout his political career. His relentless ambition, his talent for cultivating powerful mentors, his willingness to work harder than anyone else, his mastery of political mechanics, and his ability to inspire both fierce loyalty and bitter resentment all would remain constants as he climbed from congressional secretary to congressman to senator to majority leader to vice president and finally to president. Robert Caro's masterful biography reveals not just the making of a president, but the making of modern American politics. Through Johnson's story, we see how personal ambition, institutional power, and historical circumstance combine to shape both individual destinies and national policy. The young man who once declared to his classmates that he would someday be president had begun his remarkable journey. A journey that would ultimately transform America itself.